I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to another episode of Book Off, the literary podcast, with a difference. I'm Joe Haddo, and wherever you are in the world, it's great to have you with us. On today's episode, I'm joined by two brilliant crime writers who'll be going head-to-head in a war of the words a little later on in our Book Off. We'll find out which books they'll be championing a little later on, but first, let's meet them. My first guest is a former journalist who's now one of the country's best-selling crime writers, with over 2 million... count 'em, copies of his novels sold. Here to tell us about his new standalone thriller, The Cut, it's Chris Brookmire. Hello.
Hello, Joe.
So lovely to be chatting to you. Shame it's not over a pint, but we'll come to that shortly. And my second guest is the author of the Slough House novels, which have been shortlisted for 8 CWA Daggers, winning twice, and also shortlisted for Theakston's Old Peculiar Crime Novel of the Year 4 times. I am, of course, talking about Mick Herron. Welcome to Book Off, Mick.
Thanks, Joe. Hi there. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Now, we're going to talk about what you've been reading recently. Of course, we have the Book Off a little later on, when you'll each be pitching us a book you love and you think we should all read. But first, I want to discuss these brilliant new novels that you've both just published. Chris, let's talk about The Cut, if we may. This is a standalone thriller, as I mentioned. Could you just tell us a little bit about Millicent and Jerry and the story that you've got here?
Yeah, my kind of elevator pitch for this one, which is yes. appropriate term because it's a novel very much about the film world, is it's about a suicidal 72-year-old ex-con, Millicent Spark, who essentially it's about her rediscovering the joy of life as she and her 18-year-old flatmate sort of look into the mystery behind the murder for which she was jailed for 25 years. So it kind of derives from, like many of my best ideas in recent years, derives from a conversation with my wife where she told me about a practice in Scandinavia whereby older people would offer students free accommodation in, you know, very, very good accommodation for free or very much reduced, so that they would spend time with them and so there'd be this connection between the generations, so that the older people weren't losing touch with what it is to be young and the interests of the young, and vice versa, that the younger people wouldn't see old people as some kind of alien species, that they'd realise they're much like them, just older. And this idea just stuck in my head. And of course, as a crime writer, you think, yeah, someone from in their 70s and someone who's 18, and they team up to fight crime, you know, that's your immediate sort of response to it. But I had this idea for a while and then thought, how would I put that together? And somehow what crept into my head was the world of film. So it's about this woman who works in the 80s and 90s as a special effects makeup artist on slasher movies. And she one day wakes up next to the body of her lover, and she ends up jailed for this. And she's in jail for a lot longer than the normal life sentence because of various complications. And by the time she gets out, she has absolutely lost the will to live, pretty much literally. Because that was something I looked into, that people incarcerated for a long time, how they can end up losing a sort of sense of connection with everyday world once they get out.
I wondered if you'd sort of explored that with real people.
Weird things like people who'd been in jail a long time would have difficulty just going through a door because they'd be waiting for someone to unlock it. You know, and waiting for essentially permission to do the most basic things. So that was sort of one of the starting points, because I wanted to write a kind of uplifting novel. I wanted to write a novel that's very much about someone rediscovering their joie de vivre, you know, rediscovering an appetite for life. So I thought the way to do that is to show someone who's absolutely lost that appetite for life. And so she ends up living with, once she gets out of jail, with two older women as well, and they take in this student, Jerry, who is a sort of young working class kid from Ayrshire who's got this massive sense of imposter syndrome, because everyone else at university feels to him very kind of posh and confident, and he just, like we all do, feels like he's waiting for the tap on the shoulder saying, "What do you think you're doing here? You know, get out." So it's about this kind of connection, this unlikely connection between the two of them. Jerry's a film student, and he's someone who grew up raised partly by cinema. You know, he was raised by his grandmother, and partly he sees it as raised by his grandmother's video collection. So he started watching horror movies from a very early age. And so he's got this connection with Millicent because she worked in horror cinema during the sort of 80s and 90s heyday of exploitation cinema. And that, for the first time, I've really been able to draw upon my experience, because I worked for Screen International in the late 80s and early 90s.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And so most of what we covered as a trade paper was the sort of low-end independent side of the film business. I mean, you talk about independent filmmaking, people think of art house, whereas 95% of it was exploitation cinema. And I loved all that stuff. You know, the 80s, what were known as the video nasties, those were the movies I grew up on.
It had me in mind of David Cronenberg. Would that be...
He was actually regarded as a bit arty, you know, for... obviously, some of the early Cronenberg stuff would have been considered in the sort of same area as the video nasties, but this was something else I wanted to write about, that I grew up quite inspired by watching when we first got home video, Betamax video and VHS. The first thing we all did as teenagers was watch all the horror films that you wouldn't have been allowed to get in to see. This coincided with this incredible moral panic that just dominated the tabloids for years in the 1980s, when they coined the term video nasties, and this led to this hysteria that ultimately created this. The director of public prosecutions compiled a list of banned films. It sounds really, really draconian, but it was true. And there were so many of the films that were absolutely, you know, cheesy nonsense, but they were going to corrupt us all. And it did lead to people being sent to jail. You know, and it was on the basis of the most spurious, fraudulent research as well. So I wanted to write about that moral panic and show that Millicent is someone who's ultimately a victim of that moral panic. And I think it's important that the book looks at how... that moral panic kind of infects people, and it's important to see how stupid it was, you know, because the same thing will keep coming around again, and you have to remember how stupid it was the last time.
Yeah. You got a soft spot for a video nasty, Mick?
Not so much, to be honest, although I do recognise a lot of what Chris is talking about. I remember those times very well. I was very struck in the cut by all the film references, at least partly because I'm doing something similar in the book I'm writing at the moment. Although in Chris's book, many of these references take the form of a game in dialogue between Jerry and Millie, where they have to spot the lines each other are quoting. So what I like about it is you get the answers as well. If you don't recognise the quote yourself, a couple of lines later, you'll be told what movie it's from, which saves me a lot of time on Google, I think.
Yeah. Also makes you feel a little bit more clever, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. You can pretend, oh yeah, I knew that.
So thanks for that, Chris.
I was very struck by what you said about wanting to write something that was uplifting, and that was a word, or uplit was a word used on the publicity material I got when I received my copy of The Cat. And it, at first glance, it seems like an odd word to apply to Chris's work. But in fact, I've always found your work to be uplifting because of the care and concern you have towards your characters. That's always been the way. Even when they're accidentally indulging in cannibalism, I always find something really that cheers me up about the books. And they're a comfort read for me often. I go back to your books as a source of huge enjoyment and knowing that it's real classy stuff that I'll be reading.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, Mick, because I've always shied away from descriptions of my work as noir. You know, noir is a term that's just become interchangeable with crime,
yes,
really, as a genre. But there should be a distinction. And I've seldom written something that I would describe as noir, because I do like to write something that is ultimately escapist and cheering and uplifting and redemptive, you know. I mean, with the odd exception, but mostly I try to write something that could be described as uplifting, because that's kind of, I'm a far more optimistic person than people would assume.
I don't think anybody who writes sentences as long as Chris does could be accused of noir. I think noir tends to be very staccato in many ways.
I think that was a compliment, Chris.
Oh, it was. Well, I like a long sentence, I do.
It's appropriate in the context of the cut as well, because I wanted to look at that the way the sort of horror cinema grew out of things like Italian gialli cinema. And even before that, it was kind of, there was German sort of noirish cinema that led to this, but ultimately led to this exploitation cinema, which is a term that's often misunderstood, as if it's exploiting actors or exploiting people, but it was often just exploiting the next idea or the next technology. You know, if someone creates a technology that allows you to do blood spatter, there's going to be a whole load of movies exploiting that technology. And it's kind of, there's something strangely innocent about the when you read about a lot of the exploitation cinema, there was people were just often almost naively just hugely enthused by the stories they wanted to tell or the effects they wanted to have on viewers. And I guess I wanted to look at the two sides of it, and that there was a lot of fun to be had in trashy cinema, but there is another exploitation side of it, because the book does deal with sexual exploitation as well, and the fact that young women especially would be prepared to do things in order to increase their chances of becoming somebody in the film business. So it is, and that's a moral conundrum that Millicent has to kind of own up to as well, the fact that she does acknowledge that she was turning a blind eye to a lot of very dodgy things.
Now, on the back cover of your new book, Mick, which is titled Slough House, some up-and-coming author called Christopher Brookmeyer writes, Slough House is eye-wateringly funny as it is nerve-shreddingly tense, and I couldn't agree more. I suppose this is sort of following on from the fact that you were saying with Chris's book and books, there is this element of uplit, or whatever we want to call it. There's a positivity within dark stories, and you've always been keen to put this humour in your Jackson Lamb series. And I just wondered, you know, is it always there for you? Are you always just there with the lines? No matter how dark the story is, are you always going to be putting that sort of element of humour in your books?
As long as I'm writing books about these particular characters, I think so, yes, because this is now the tone of the series. And I can't really see that I would want to change it, or that it would be acceptable to change it now. But it came about really back when writing the first novel in the sequence, Slow Horses. It started to feel to me like the appropriate tone to adopt for writing about these people. If I were writing the same plots but with a different approach, you know, if I just had a lone hero or something of that nature, then the tone would be entirely different. But it seemed to me that I was writing about people who were kind of miserable and thwarted and frustrated, And I felt that they're having them bickering a lot of the time, which is where much of the humour, as far as I'm concerned, comes from, seemed to be the right way to describe their lives. Otherwise, I'd just be writing about a lot of unhappy people not coping very well. And that's that would be the opposite of uplifting, I feel.
I think it would, somehow, yes.
Is there such a thing as downlift? Maybe I can invent downlift.
There's something to be said that we all need a wee bit of the essence of Roddy Ho. So it just seems to be almost...
There's to be a master of the universe, you mean?
Yeah, a degree of happiness about this complete lack of self-awareness. It's like a lifestyle guide, you know, if you could be a bit more Roddy, you'd probably be quite happy.
Yeah.
Probably quite happy, yes. Yeah. Being a dickhead means never having to say you're sorry. But I enjoy writing about Roddy because I can adopt, you know, for the time that I'm inside his head, I can quite happily just adopt his approach to the world and see it all as being there for him, laid out in front of him in great splendor. And he is the center of everything. And it's, I mean, from an individual point of view, it's quite a positive way, as Chris says, of looking at things in terms of, you know, social interaction and so on. It's perhaps a bit of a minus.
Yeah. Yes, there's a great moment in Slough House where I won't give it away, but just that Roddy's very proud of his tradecraft en route to, is it Highgate Cemetery? And there's quite the sting there, which I particularly appreciated.
He's a ninja.
Yes.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about Slough House? Because Jackson and his crew are feeling a little paranoid in this one, Mick. Tell us about the story.
Jackson and his crew are feeling paranoid because of events at the end of the previous novel, really. I tried to keep my novel self-contained, but when you're writing a series, you don't want to press a reset button at the beginning of each book because that's just not how life works. So at the end of Joe Country, they discovered that Slough House itself and all records pertaining to it had been wiped from the service records. They'd been kind of disavowed, if you want me to adopt the Mission Impossible language. And part of the book is about them coming to understand why that's happened. And the other half of the book, and these two things come together, of course, is the consequences of an actual legitimate operation from Regent's Park, which is what I call the main body of the Secret Service in my world, carrying out an act of vengeance, really, in return for murders carried out on British soil by the Russian Secret Service. And this more or less triggers a situation of undeclared war between the two services. And Slough House, because of their new status or lack of status, even lacquer of status, perhaps I should say, find themselves very much in the front line of this undeclared war. And mayhem ensues. I think this is what I always have to say.
That's what I was waiting for, yeah. I want to come back. Chris, you mentioned your wife earlier and how, you know, the ideas for books have sparked from conversations with her. I want to talk about one of your other writing projects that is with her, the Ambrose Parry pseudonym. Before that, Mick, can I just ask? I can't tell if the question I'm about to ask is a really obvious one that you've never been asked before and you've been waiting, or if it's insulting in some way. So here goes. Is it you on the front cover of this book?
No, it isn't. I'm not sure who it is. There was a picture in the Times at the weekend with a montage of various spies and you know, actors playing spies, Connery and Oldman, people like that. And a friend asked me why the article had was talking about Slough House, and the friend expressed disappointment that I wasn't included in this photo montage. And I said, "Oh well, actually, the silhouette you can see of the guy holding a gun—that is me." And she believed me. It was, in fact, Daniel Craig, as far as I'm aware. But the similarities between us are really quite extreme. I often get stopped in the street and you know, asked when the new Bond movie is coming out.
Well, I don't know why. It caught my eye because it's a very eye-catching cover. But then I thought, oh, I wonder if that's Mick sort of just putting himself into the into the cover there with a nice trilby on. Anyway, obviously it's not, and we can all move on. But maybe one for the future.
Actually, we were looking at cover designs for The Cut, And there was just some fantastic designs, some that were maybe just a little too dark or whatever. But there was one that got rejected. It was a nice enough cover design, but it had this woman on it that just something about it. I pointed out that she's on the cover of this book and it's called The Cut. It did look like it was going to be about hairdressing. You know, so we had to be very careful with that.
There's an untapped readership out there, Chris.
And Chris, another of your writing projects, as I said, it's with your wife, the Ambrose Parry pseudonym. How has that been for you, working with your wife, but also in sort of such close quarters? Because we all, you know, if we have partners and we live with them, we can't sort of escape them at the moment, can we?
Well, I think we've been very fortunate in that Marissa and I had several years to get used to being in the same house all the time, and we'd started working together. I've bumped into other writers, or rather talked to other writers, and occasionally talked to people in the street who work at home and who'd always worked at home, and they weren't finding it so easy that if their spouse was now also around the house all day. You know, they were used to the house being very much their own domain from, you know, 9 to 5. But I'm very much privileged that Marissa and I had kind of developed that relationship for a few years, and we essentially we made the best of the pandemic situation, in that all those festivals that we were talking about, all those things that aren't going on anymore, we were able to write another Ambrose Parry book over the summer because there was nothing to interrupt it. And the big upside for me about working with Marissa is I've been very prolific in recent years. I've essentially been delivering a book every 9 months in order to keep two publishers happy. But the upside is that it's only every alternate book where I have to come up with an idea. You know, the Ambrose Parry books, is Marissa does all the research to think about what we should write about, and then she works on the story, she starts working on the themes. So by the time I've delivered a novel and I'm sitting down with her to talk about the Ambrose Parry book, an awful lot of it's already been decided. So it meant that in the spring of last year, when I'd just delivered The Cut, I was able to just look at what Marissa had already come up with, and then we spent a few weeks sort of developing the idea, and then we both just got busy writing it. We wrote it in about 4 months. Because we've become very efficient now. We've evolved how we work together, and now not only will Marissa go off and write chapters on her own, but now I like to write by walking, which was tricky during the only allowed out once a day phase of the lockdown last year. But fortunately at that point I was quite close to the end of The Cut. But what I'll do is I go out for a
walk.
Puts
a lot of pressure on that one walk, doesn't it?
It did, yeah. They were pretty long walks, I'll confess that much. But I would time it. You know, I wouldn't go walking until I'd finished writing something that I knew and, you know, needed to plan the next bit. But what I was doing over the summer was I would go for a long walk and sort of dictate ideas or dictate material to myself, then transcribe it, then hand that to Marissa and say, right, you turn that into something coherent. And that was actually quite efficient, but it's been great because I think the whole world of Ambrose Parry, the 19th century medicine, was such an exciting time, especially in Edinburgh, and it's something I just would not be able to comprehend. You know, I wouldn't be able to take that on, even though it's interesting, because I wouldn't have the knowledge and the understanding of it from a kind of technical and even from a historical point of view. But Marissa has all of that, and she knows where the drama and the stories are that other people might overlook. So it's essentially I've got this kind of guide into this world that makes it so much easier for us to write about it.
Yeah, fantastic. I'm an absolute fan of the walk and think as well, I have to say, and really finding it hard not to be able to go on, well, more than one walk, or indeed a particularly long one. And I do think there's something about, you know, it doesn't happen instantly necessarily either. It's not like when you get home from that walk, you sit down and everything, you know, that's in your brain gets put on the page. But actually, it could be a couple of days later that what's percolated is suddenly available, you know, and I think that's so important. Have you got a bit of countryside where you are, Mick, in Oxfordshire?
Do indeed, yes. We're quite lucky here. I'm on the outskirts of the city, and there's plenty of greenland and river around. Although now, it has to be said, right at the moment, it's mostly river. We've got a lot of floodwater covering the local meadows. But I agree about the walking thing. I've often find that that's the best time for planning. I think of it as a ponder wander. I go for ponder wanders. And they're one of the many things I do where I can justify by saying, look, I am working. It may look like I'm just kind of wandering around slowly with my hands in my pockets staring at the ground, but I am in fact working when I do this, just as I'm working when I am lying on my sofa with my eyes shut, or when I am having the second snack of the morning while I'm building my way up to brunch. It's all work.
And am I right in thinking that Jackson Lamb will soon be coming to our screens in glorious Technicolor?
The word soon has that kind of a lasting meaning at the moment, doesn't it? I mean, it is being filmed at the moment, or at least production has certainly started, and I've been on set for a day and seen them doing it. I don't know what's happening, you know, today as we speak, or for the past couple of weeks even. But yes, it's all taking place. I can't talk very much about it because it's being made by Apple TV, and they like to play their cards very close to their chest, and they haven't released the full cast details, for instance. And much of what's going on is regarded as being sort of top secret. I don't know whether this is what they always do or whether they think this is particularly appropriate for a series about spies. But either way, for a long time, all I could do when asked about the show was just repeat the words Gary Oldman over again. That was all I was allowed to say. But nevertheless, they're very good words, and I'm very happy to be able to say them. To have Gary Oldman playing Jackson Lamb is a huge privilege, not only because of him being such a wonderful actor, but the very fact that he played George Smiley in the Tinker Tailor movie is for me, you know, I hug that knowledge to my chest. It gives me a thrill every time I think of it.
God, I'd be telling anyone and everyone if that was the case, you know. Be like, oh, Gary Oldman, you fan of Gary Oldman? Yeah, he's playing the character that I created, actually. Just dropping it in at every point.
Absolutely.
Now, it's been obvious already that you have read each other's books, and I think this is a very common thing in the crime writing community because it's such a close-knit community. Everyone is very supportive of each other, and everyone seems to genuinely read everyone else's books, I think, because they enjoy them. Not out of a sense of you're a better read so-and-so's book. I think it's genuine. And I just wondered what you'd both been reading recently and if there's anything that you wanted to recommend to us. Chris, have you been on a bit of a reading streak?
Yeah, I think after the intense experience of writing the new Ambrose book, I did enjoy being able to read a few things, and mostly it was the sort of pile of things being sent by editors or by some of my fellow crime writers. And one of the books that stood out was actually a science fiction book. It's just coming out now by Derek B. Miller, who wrote Norwegian by Night, and it's called Radio Life. And it's like this post-apocalyptic kind of Mad Max type world, but I think I best describe it as, it's like if you imagine Mad Max is written by like Neal Stephenson, because it's very much about technology and a relationship with information, and it's very atmospheric, hugely compelling. And also I just read Imran Mahmoud's book, I Know What I Saw, which is this brilliantly Hitchcockian book about unreliable, it's this rather unreliable narrator who's been homeless for decades, and it was absolutely fascinating, truly gripping. And but do you know my go-to at the moment for comfort in the midst of all the sort of depredations of the pandemic is I'm just binge reading Marion Keyes, because her work is so, there's just this kind of warmth and humanity and comfort to it. And it's, on the surface, it can be about the small things, but actually what's comforting is you realise these are the big things, these sort of small things in people's relationships, they're far more important than a sort of world of guns and explosions. And her books will make you laugh and make you cry, but ultimately you'll feel like we can make it will all be okay by the time you get to the end.
That's so true. Well, that's a brilliant set of recommendations, a very different ends of the scale there. Thank you, Chris. And what about you, Mick? Have you been finding time to read?
Oh, always find time to read, yeah. I've been doing, as I think many people have over the past year, a lot of comfort reading in the sense of, you know, revisiting authors whom I know and love. Just last weekend, I picked up The Constant Gardener for the first time since it was published, I think. It's only the first time I've reread that book. And was immediately transported, not just into the world of that novel, but into Le Carré's world, which is a world developed by his prose. I think he's one of those writers whom you can spot immediately from the way they write, who it is who's doing it. And I find that it kind of washes over me. And I have to be very careful. I could quite easily find myself writing in the same registers that he uses if I'm not careful. So I've been doing quite a lot of that sort of reading, a lot of Val as well, in fact, Val McDermott, rereading a number of her standalones particularly, and being amazed by the, I knew they were good when I first read them, but I don't think I've appreciated quite how good something like A Place of Execution is. Extraordinary novel. But a newish book that I read just recently and deeply impressed me was by Liz Moore called Long Bright River. Have either of you guys read that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. She was on this very podcast last year, actually.
Right. I was recommending this book about a year ago. It takes me quite a long time to get around to following up on recommendations, but it blew me away. It was extraordinary. I noticed that Dennis Lehane had words to say on the cover, and it did very much remind me of his writing in his more serious tone, Mystic River particularly, where he's not only writing, I'll talk about Liz's book rather than Dennis Lehane's. Liz Moore is not only writing about a crime investigation, but she's writing about a whole community and the depredations it has suffered over the past 20 years of economic decline, a community that's largely at the prey of drug dealers and unemployment and the like, and people trying to live, you know, decent lives within that awful context. And I was most taken with it. It's heartily recommended, Long Bright River. I'm not sure if it's out in paperback yet, but it really should be a bestseller, I think.
I feel like it probably is, because I seem to recall that we recorded an episode of Book Off with Liz back in sort of February last year, I think. So I have a feeling it's probably just coming out in paperback. But it also, it really stuck with me. Like, the actual imagery of that book really stayed with me for a long time, and even now talking about it, I can sort of bring it back. You know, there was something about her descriptions in that novel that you know just really stood out for me.
I haven't been in a bookshop recently, which is why I'm not sure what format it's available in. It's not her first novel. I must go back and explore her previous books, but I look forward to more of the same from her.
Fantastic. Well, thank you both for those recommendations. I've been scribbling down on the list here.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And now it's time for the Book Off. This is where each of you is going to have 3 minutes on the clock to tell us about a book you absolutely love and you think that we should all read. Now, you don't have to use your 3 minutes if you don't want to, but once you reach that mark, I'm going to be ringing you out with the school bell, or I'm going to be honking you out with the bicycle horn. So we need to decide who goes first, who goes second. Chris, you're alphabetically first, so would you like to go first or second?
I'm going to chuck it over to Mick.
And Mick, would you like the bicycle horn or the school bell to serenade you out at 3 minutes?
Oh, I think it's going to have to be a school bell, I think. Yeah. I was about to complain there about this being the last unacknowledged ground of discrimination there, the whole alphabet thing. He was a great gentleman. Well,
he was a great gentleman. But also, you got to choose the comedy part. You know, you had this technically the more exciting choice to make. just before we start, Chris, what book are you putting up for the book off?
It's Swing Hammer Swing by Jeff Torrington.
Fantastic. And what about you, Mick?
I'm putting up Collected Poems by Derek Mann.
Wonderful. Wow, two very different books, but can't wait to hear these. Mick, it's over to you. I'm putting 3 minutes on the clock, uninterrupted, to tell us about Derek Mann's Collected Poems. Over to you.
Okay. I'll spend the first part of that quoting one of the poems, in fact. Back last March, when the pandemic was just starting to take a grip, on the RTA News in Ireland, they've closed a broadcast with Derek Mann reading this poem, which I'll read now. Everything is going to be all right. How should I not be glad to contemplate the clouds clearing beyond the dormer window and a high tide reflected on the ceiling? There will be dying, but there is no need to go into that. The lines flow from the hand unbidden, and the hidden source is the watchful heart. The sun rises in spite of everything, and the far cities are beautiful and bright. I lie here in a riot of sunlight, watching the daybreak and the clouds flying. Everything is going to be all right. I think you can understand why that poem is chosen at that particular moment. But it's a poem that means a lot to me and has done for decades. I, in fact, used that line as the closing line of my first novel, Down Cemetery Road, back in 2000, I think it was. Anyway, Mann, as a poet, grew up or was educated in Dublin, and he was part of a trio of poets, the other two being Seamus Heaney and Michael Longley, who really established Ireland as one of the great centres of poetry at that time. He himself went on to live in various places all over the world, particularly in New York for a long time, and was a very, after a period of not writing at all, became very prolific, so much so that my copy of Collected Poems was superseded a few years later by a new Collected Poems with another two volumes of poetry in it. And since then, there were further two collections before he died on the 1st of October last year. I admire Mann for many, many reasons. He was a poet of great formal abilities, as can be seen by much of his translation work. He was a poet who could translate work from the classical or European languages and preserve the rhyme schemes in which they were originally written, which is quite extraordinary. One of the things that really impresses me about Mann is the way that he continually engaged with his work throughout his life. So poems that appeared in the Collected and later Collecteds were revised from their first appearance, as if he continued to feel that there was some form of the work that he was aiming towards, and he never put them away. He never thought that once they're down on paper, they were finished. In fact, one of my favourite poems of his when it first appeared was about 6 or 7 stanzas long, each of the stanzas 9 lines long. And the version in the Collected Poems I've got here is simply 9 lines long. And I've never understood quite why he revised it to that extent. If poetry is meant to do anything, then I think consolation is one of the main things that we look for when we look at verse. And I'm going to read a part of another poem now, which has been with me for decades now. This is from a poem called Leaves. Somewhere there is an afterlife of dead leaves, a stadium filled with an infinite rustling and sighing. Somewhere in the heaven of our lost futures, the lives we might have led have found their own fulfillment. I've carried that last stanza around in my head for decades now. It's a form of consolation for me, and that notion that the choices we make find their own conclusion somewhere or another is one that I find really, really heartening.
Oh, and in comes the school bell, cutting you down in your prime there. I tell you what, we'll come back and talk about it in a moment, Mick, but I absolutely loved that pitch. I don't read enough poetry, and actually every time we talk about Collected Works, we talk about a poet I don't really know, it makes me remember that I need to sort of up my game. But have a rest. Have a cup of tea. You've done your 3 minutes. It's over to Chris now. I'm going to put 3 minutes back on the clock for you, Chris. And it's over to you to tell us about Swing Hammer Swing.
Well, Swing Hammer Swing by Jeff Torrington, the late Jeff Torrington, is to me it's the great overlooked classic of Scottish 20th century literature. When I say overlooked, in that it won the Whitbread Prize in 1992, but inexplicably went out of print at one point. It is one of the funniest novels I've ever read. The best pitch I could offer for it is if you could imagine one of those sprawling Billy Connolly routines where he's telling a story, but imagine that for 400 pages. It's a book about a guy called Tam Clay, who his wife is in hospital because she's pregnant, but she's got preeclampsia, so she's having to stay in hospital until the baby's born. And this coincides with them knocking down the Gorbals, where he lives. So it's set in the 1960s, and I think to some extent it's autobiographical about Torrington living there at the time. And when people talk about the Gorbals, they're always thinking about, they're sort of synonymous with Glasgow poverty. But it's a depiction of this as this kind of very vibrant place full of these crazy pubs and surreal things going on. You know, it's sort of the novel that starts with a guy in a deep sea diver's costume emerging from a cinema in the snow, and he's been sent out to plug Yellow Submarine, which is going to be playing at the cinema that week. But it's just this very inventive novel. The language in it is constantly inventive. I read it again every few years because it's like tapping up the patter supplies. You know, you read this book and it makes you up your game in terms of the inventive humour you put into your own language. It's hysterically funny again and again. I maintain that I was reluctant to read it at first because it had won a major literary prize, and I thought that meant it was going to be really miserable. And I think that they gave it the prize because it was round about the time of early 90s. There'd been sort of like magic realism from South America in the 80s. I think they thought this was going to be the Glaswegian equivalent, and they didn't realise that the surrealism was actually a fairly accurate depiction of a Glasgow Saturday night. Because it's full of these bizarre things, like death turning up to a public toilet. There's a description of the local GPs where he's not there, it's a locum, but a woman describes him as the locust, and talks about someone dying of an infarct, you know, and saying, "So you told you it's dangerous to hold them in." You know, but it is just a very inventive, very kind of life-affirming book. But it's also about the end of something and the beginning of something else. They're knocking down the Gorbals just as he's about to become a father. So there you go. There's the end of me pitch.
Oh, wonderfully done as well. Well done, Chris. Thank you. Loved both of those. Mick, I love Seamus Heaney, and I was introduced to him as quite young, thanks to me dad. But Derek Marne, I don't know for my sins well at all. And I loved your reading of the poem straight off, because I think in talking about poetry, it's good to just get a taste of it, to sort of get the sense of what we're talking about here. And it just sounded great. The line that you used in Cemetery Road as well, that I love that it's sort of, you were influenced by that line and that sort of appeared in your writing. I love that that's cross-pollinated.
I drop quite a lot of lines of verse into the books where I can. I don't normally own up to it like this, though. I was interested in what Chris said there about being put off by something appearing literary. I think many people steer away from poetry because they worry that it's, you know, it's not for them for whatever reason. You know, it will be, you know, too highfalutin or whatever. But Marne speaks, I think he speaks to, you know, the contemporary, and he talks about real concerns, and we see how a poem like Everything Will Be All Right just matters very much at the moment, and seems eerily prescient, really, given that it was written, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah. And how often do you sort of sit down and read poetry, would you say?
I always have a collection on the go. I have a small pile of books next to my sofa where I lounge, and at least one of them is always a collection of verse. At the moment, it's Christopher Reed's The Late Sun. So pretty much every day I will pick something up and read a poem or two. Yeah.
Well, you've inspired me to definitely read more.
I find it useful as a discipline as well. I mean, the one thing that poetry has that prose often doesn't is a acute observance of how many words go on a line, you know, so you can feel that, you know, there's a certain syllabic weight to words. And you appreciate that more, I think, in poetry, reading poetry, than you do reading prose. But it's a very useful thing to carry over when you're writing prose, to be aware of the rhythm of sentences and the size of the words that you're using.
And I loved, Chris, that you said you go back to Swing Hammer Swing every few years, and that it's sort of, you know, the by reading this inventive novel and the language in it, that it sort of helps inspire you. I don't know it. I thought the fact that you, the sort of comparison to 400 pages of a Billy Connolly rant just makes me want to instantly pick it up. And, you know, being put off because it won a literary prize, you know, I think that can happen sometimes. And yet, when you tell me that there's a scene about death coming up to a public toilet, you know, I'm instantly sold.
Yeah, it's a kind of constantly energetic and mischievous novel as well, because the character of Tam Clay is a bit of a rogue. He's kind of running away from responsibility, and that's to some extent what the book is about. It's about his world is literally being knocked down, which is kind of what happens when you become a parent, you know, and the world of pubs and masculine pursuits is all going away. But it does that without being melancholy or sentimental. It's a very unsentimental book, but it's also very philosophical. And I think it's the kind of book that's comforting in that respect, because there's something meditative about writing it, but it's about reading it, but it's also just constantly, you know, hysterically funny.
And I assume it's back in print now.
Yeah. I think largely due to my evangelism over the years.
Oh, it's nice to have that power, isn't it? Well, look, I loved both of those pictures. I think Mix made me want to, and also awful made me feel a little bit bad about not reading enough poetry. It's made me want to go back and pick some books off the shelves and just sort of delve in. And
if I've made just one person feel bad today, Joe, then I feel that my job has been done.
Yes, I think you've won there in that respect. And I don't know Swing Hammer Swing, and I must. I feel like Jeff Torrington is going to be added to my bookshop.org order this week. But based on those pitches, it's a tough one, and they're both very different, but I'm going to take home Swing Hammer Swing. Just clinched it, Chris.
An understandable choice.
For the humour alone, I think it was the Billy Connolly thing that sort of swung it. But I also now must check out Derek Mahn, so thank you for that, Mick. Both brilliant choices. The Cut by Chris Brookmyer is out now. It's published by Sphere, and Slough House by Mick Herron is also out, published by John Murray, and they are fabulous books. You must get them and put them on your shelves. Well, read them first and then put them on your shelves. Chris, Mick, what an absolute pleasure. If only it could have been in person, but here's hoping that Harrogate could be an actual thing this year.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Let's hope so.
Shoulders to that vaccine.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, jab me up, I say. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
You too, Joe. Thanks, and lovely to speak to you.
And you too. Thanks,
again.
Joe. Cheers, Chris.
Cheers, man.
Bye now.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.